Now, last time I tried to give you a kind of introduction into Romanticism and to make clear that it is related and yet separate at the same time from Pietism and Evangelism, which we treated earlier. And I quoted from one of the great documents at the beginning of Romanticism, Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe. The other great document you are reading, though there is a third, which is Rousseau's Confession, which I quoted as well. But apart from these three documents, there is, at least in Germany, also something that is not a document, properly speaking, but a symbol, the symbol of the blue flower of Romanticism, which went on into the German youth movement at the turn of the century and up to the Second World War. And perhaps before we come to Werther, which is, after all, the third great document standing at the beginning of Romanticism, and the document that you are reading, I should perhaps read you the passage of Novalis about the blue flower, because it is relevant and it adds another dimension as we are starting with nature and the idea of nature. And this is the passage of 1802, later than Werther, perhaps the last of the great documents of Romanticism, of Novalis's Heinrich von Ofterdingen. The hero of this novel, Heinrich, found himself, and I quote now, found himself on a soft lawn bordering a spring which seemed to dissolve itself into the air. Dark blue rocks with colored veins rose in the distance. The daylight which surrounded him was clearer and milder than usual, and the sky was dark blue and without cloud. But what powerfully attracted him was a tall and light blue flower which stood next to the spring and touched it with its brilliant petals. It was surrounded by flowers of all possible colors, and their delicious scent filled the air. But he saw nothing else but the blue flower and contemplated it for a long time with great tenderness. This, then, is the famous blue flower of the Romantics. But it is prefaced by a typical passage which tells us that this blue flower symbolized a dream as over against the regularities of common life. In other words, the blue flower is part of a dream as over against the dreariness and the regularities of common life. As Goethe says, he who loves systems expels love from his heart. Again, it is the exceptional that is important as over against the regularity. Eventually, the petals of the blue flower open, and out of these petals comes the face of Heinrich's love, Mathilde. Mathilde, who is herself described as heavenly, who dissolves Heinrich, as he puts it, into music, who guards the holy flame of his soul. And there are, at the beginning of Romanticism, three ideal women: Rebecca in Ivanhoe, about which I talked last time; Charlotte in Werther, about which you are reading; and Mathilde in Novalis, Heinrich von Ofterding. And these women are all the same. They are connected to flowers as symbols of virtues and chastity and purity. They are exceptional. They symbolize the exceptional, if you like, the exceptional, the unusual. They are opposed to the dreariness of daily life. that is also clear. And in Charlotte, again, they are different from man and masculinity. They are different, as Goethe says about Charlotte. She is simplicity and intelligence. And that can be said about Rebecca, that can be said about Matilda. Simplicity in an ever more complex world. Intelligence as well. But an intelligence which in Charlotte, typically enough, is turned to domesticity. An intelligence that is turned to the domestic, to her lover, to the domestic, to whatever, as you read there. As Charlotte says, I like the authors best who describe my own situation in life, the friends who are about me, my family, my domestic life. In other words, everything, including the ideal woman, is related to the self, to the ego. Everything in Romanticism comes out of the own soul, is reflected of the soul herself. Everything is personalized. And that is again made clear to you, very clear to you, I hope, by the children in Werther. The children with whom Charlotte is constantly surrounded. Not so much as the mother of the children, which she is not. Remember, that is very important. Charlotte is not the mother of these children. She is, if you like, the sister of these children. But Charlotte and the children together are the symbols of innocence. The symbols of innocence, simplicity in life, just as the woman in Rousseau's Confession, for that matter. The woman, therefore, becomes the symbol of innocence, of purity, of chastity, of virtue, of the exceptional, of the thing that is longed for in a life that was far from innocent, that was getting ever more complex, more urbanized, more industrialized. The reflection also, if you like, of the man, the eternal other, as it were, the eternal other. For though, of course, Werther is in love with Charlotte, Charlotte is also Werther's better self. And that whole phrase, which is so common in Europe, though you may no longer know it, that she is my better self, a phrase that is used about women in my generation. She, my wife, is my better self. This idea that she is a reflection of yourself, but as Werther says of Charlotte, the guardian of your holy flame, the guardian of your soul, shows you that she is a symbol of Romanticism, but also a reflection, as it were, a personalization. But it is not only the passages about children, the model of innocence. Charlotte reflects something that Werther is always reaching for, and which we might describe as unspoiled feeling. As Werther puts it, all the knowledge I possess, everybody else can acquire, but my heart is my own. This longing for personalization, which is a longing for uniqueness, but this longing for uniqueness is also in Werther a longing to get out of the dreariness of daily life, to get the exceptional as the blue flower. And you see here something quite different from Nathan. Remember the dialogues in Nathan the Wise between Daya and Nathan. Nathan thinks dreaming is bad. In Romanticism, the dream becomes all important. The dream is not only good, the dream reflects your better self. It reflects the exceptional. So you can see the difference between the Enlightenment and Romanticism also in how they regarded dreaming. The blue flower is a dream. The more Heinrich reaches for the blue flower, the more it dissolves. It is a dream. But Nathan would have greatly disapproved of dreaming. with Nathan, it is reason, it is doing, it is activizing. And from that also comes in Romanticism something that I have already mentioned, the mal du monde, the grieving about the world, the kind of despair. The dream is never to be fulfilled. Well, certainly not for Werther. Werther, after all, commits suicide. The dream is never fulfilled. Werther does not marry Charlotte. Charlotte, in a way, goes into the world. She marries Albrecht, and Albrecht is reason. Albrecht is bureaucracy. Albrecht is not only compromise with this world, he is this world. He deals in facts and figures. He deals in system. Charlotte, innocence, the dream, is marrying the world, is marrying Albrecht. He is marrying the world. And that is, of course, more than Werther can bear. The dream must not be compromised by this world. And so, after all, he does commit suicide. And Heinrich von Ofterdingen is much the same idea. Matilda also, in the end, compromises with the world. And when German youth, at the end, turn of the century, left their homes and families, left the Berlin suburb of Steglitz, where it was founded, they were looking for the blue flower, and they too could never find the blue flower. But the ultimate denouement, the ultimate revelation of this search, comes when they thought that they had found the blue flower. They had thought they had found the blue flower as they went off and enlisted in the First World War. This is what we call the generation of 1914, the generation that enlisted in the war. The war was their blue flower, their way of getting out of the dreariness of daily life, their way of innocence. Not only in Germany, but in England, Rupert Brooke's famous poem of the First World War, the poem everyone learned, compared the war to a clean river, the kind of river that Werther, that for Werther is the symbolism of cleanliness. The First World War is, Rupert Brooke says, like jumping into a clean river. And indeed, for these volunteers of 1914, it was a cleanliness, a cleansing from system, from facts and figures, a cleansing from this world, as it were. The opposite from Albrecht, a dream, a reaching for a blue flower. Well, of course, there too in the First World War, the reaching of the blue flower ended in death, not in suicide, but in death. So there is in all of this Werther romantic, in all of this romantic of the blue flower, the idea of death built in, the idea of a kind of despair, of a Weltschmerz, a mal du monde, of a world, in Rousseau's terms, that has gone wrong. But a world that is now gone wrong, that Werther wants to escape, Werther and German youth, Werther and the generation of 1914 in Germany and England, wanted to escape by personalizing everything, by looking for the unique to the exceptional. And indeed, the chief soldier song of 1914, not sung by the elder conscripts, but sung by the young volunteer, was a song of the German youth movement, a song of the blue flower, of longing for the blue flower and hoping to find it in the trenches of Flanders. Well, unfortunately, they found something quite different in the trenches of Flanders, but they also found death, finally, because, of course, there is no way out. There was no way Goethe could have ended this but by suicide. And so you get the image of Werther, the image of the misunderstood genius. the end of this kind of narcissism, the end of this kind of narcissism, the misunderstood genius inspiring a whole a generation. Now, in this, of course, nature again, which I talked to you about last time with the Alps and the rush to the Alps, which comes at the same time, nature plays a great role. After all, there is always a correspondence between nature and Werther, always a kind of correspondence. On August the 18th, Werther writes, "All this conveyed to me the holy fire, which animates all nature, and filled and glowed within my heart. I felt myself exalted by this overflowing fullness to the perception of the Godhead and the glorious form of an infinite universe stirred within my soul." Again, everything is absorbed within yourself. It becomes a reflection of you. And in Werther, this is obviously totally clear. Nature always corresponds directly to his mood, directly to his mood. From the beginning, when nature is beneficent, and he sees Charlotte in the midst of this beneficent landscape, to, I remind you, at the end, when everything is collapsing, and nature now corresponds to thunder and lightning, to corresponds to the waterfall, to the threatening waterfall, and no longer, as it were, to the beneficent nature at the beginning. So you must follow not only Werther himself, but the change of nature, which is the change of his mood. And the favorite tree of the Romantics was the weeping willow tree, which in a way symbolized this mal du monde for them, this mal du monde, or the waterfall, or indeed the awesome and stupendous mountains that I talked about last time and tried to illustrate to you last time what that actually meant. The feeling of nature is reflected in another way too, in the introduction, in a sense, in, let me see, right at the beginning, on May the 4th. On May the 4th, and I have to give dates because our page numbers don't correspond. On May the 4th, he describes the garden in which he will see Charlotte, and he describes it in a very significant way. He says, "The garden is simple, and it is easy to see as soon as one answers that the plan was not designed by a scientific gardener." And here you get the great difference between the 18th century garden and the Romantic garden. The gardens of Versailles, designed by a scientific gardener, as I told you once before, the straight paths, the folly at the end of the vista, which I told you once before, and the garden of Charlotte, the Romantic garden, the garden that is simple but wild, which has a name, by the way, which you should know. It's called the English garden because it was first done in England. So when you come to Munich today and you see the park in Munich called the English garden, the English garden, that was an assertion of romanticism against Versailles and against the gardens of this nature. But notice something else. These gardens are wild and simple. What does it mean, simple? Because we'll have it again next week when we come to Rousseau's Government for Poland. Everything must be simple. Simple here is a bad translation for genuine. The gardens are simple. Simple is a bad translation. It should really be genuine, a genuine garden. Nature in the raw, nature in the raw. Genuineness, not artificiality, just as the soul is genuine, as the correspondence of landscape and soul is genuine. Nature and the individual corresponding in the end becomes what? It becomes what we must call the cult of romantic genius. The cult of romantic genius, misunderstood genius, romantic genius. And here, May the 26th has the important passages to you. This confirmed me, said Werther, in my resolution of adhering entirely to nature. Nature alone is inexhaustible and capable of forming the great master. Much may be alleged in favor of rules, but as much as may be said in favor of middle-class society. An artist modeled after them will never produce anything absolutely bad or in poor taste, just as man who observes the laws of society and decorum can never be entirely unwelcome. But all this destroys the genuine feeling of nature, the genuine feeling of nature. So in other words, the opposition to banality, the opposition to moderation, you will see here, which was so important in everything we've studied up to now. The opposition to moderation, the opposition to moderation, immoderation inspired by nature. For the Romantics, nature was immoderate. For the Enlightenment, it was moderate. For the Romantics, it was immoderate. Nature, therefore, inspires immoderation, the opposite to middle-class life, the opposite to middle-class life, the revolt against middle-class life. And so out of Romanticism comes a certain revolt against middle-class life, against middle-class manners and morals. A revolt that is first symbolized, I suppose, by the poet Byron, that is later on symbolized in the 1840s by a whole group of Frenchmen known as the Bohemians, to which I shall come back in another connection. The Bohemians, a kind of revolt of romantic genius, which is not a revolt of society or against society, but an individualized revolt. Now, this is for us extremely important because what it leads to eventually is again to a phenomena of the end of the century, to what we might call the artistic avant-garde. That is to a revolt against middle-class manners and morals, which is an individualized revolt, an artistic revolt, a revolt that is personalized rather than a social and economic revolution. And without this background, for which this passage, in a sense, of Werther of May the 29th, of romantic genius lays the foundation. The romantic genius who hurls himself against society and conventions. That becomes typical for a certain type of revolution, a revolution which I call the bourgeois, anti-bourgeois revolution, the revolution of middle-class children against middle-class parents. The kind of revolution which becomes the important revolution in Europe, which becomes the important revolution because it is the revolution of the avant-garde, the revolution of the expressionists, the impressionists, of the youth movements, the German youth movement, the Jewish youth movement, of all youth movements. In other words, the important revolution, which is not social and economic at all, but which is a revolution in the quest for exceptionality, or the revolution in the quest for something outside rules and regulation, the revolution of romantic genius, which in the end will become the fascist revolution. That is to say, the successful revolution is not the socialist revolution. It's been a complete failure. The successful revolution is in fact what I call the bourgeois anti-bourgeois revolution. the revolution in quest of exceptionality, in quest of festivals, which Rousseau, in his book on Poland, which you will read, will foreshadow so well. The revolution in quest of festivals, the exceptional, in quest of individuality, not in quest of society, in quest of individuality, in quest of the genuine, in quest, as it were, therefore, the inquest in a sense of death as well, yes, in quest of the blue flower, the blue flower. Fascism, in the end, the great thing about fascism was that it promised to bring the blue flower to a whole generation of youth which joined it, for fascism was nothing if not a youth movement. It was at first another kind of youth movement, not a movement of adults at all. Now here, of course, then, you have the quest for self-fulfillment, the quest for what Werther still calls, in the end, innocent delusions, innocent delusions. And these innocent delusions, again, symbolized here by the children, symbolized by Charlotte, the withdrawal from the world of Nathan the Wise into the world of dreams. But the world of dreams is a highly personalized world, the world of innocent delusions, the world, as it were, of a kind of narcissism, which you see. Now, this is why fairy tales are important. And there is a fairy tale built in to Werther, which you may find difficult to understand in case you don't know what it is. But the tale which Werther at the end reads to Charlotte is the tale of Ossian. The tale of Ossian is one of the first rediscovered fairy tales. The tale of Ossian, which Werther reads to Charlotte, the fairy tales. Now remember that this is the time of the rediscovery of fairy tales. The fairy tales were first rediscovered in England towards the end of the 18th century. And that these fairy tales were thought to be nothing else but highly symbolic tales. Now I'll come back to them, of course. Symbolic tales going back to the roots of humanity, to the roots of the people, the roots of the nation, the genuine tales. The tale that you know best, I suppose, the tale of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, is what you may not know, of course, a tale of Germanic gods. And I will reserve explaining it to you until we come to the rise of nationalism. Now, because this fairy tale, the tale of Germanic gods, is a tale of genuineness, is a dream, as it were, but a dream of the Germanic gods. Well, that is missing in Werther. Werther, Goethe was no nationalist of any kind. He was still a man of the Enlightenment. Therefore, his Ossian is not tied to nationalism. But in England, where that fairy tale was first discovered, which Goethe here uses, the fairy tale becomes a tale of national symbolism. The death in it is death in a way for the sake of England, for the sake of the people, and all of this. But this is, again, in Goethe, highly personalized. It becomes, in a way, the legend of Ossian, which is an Irish legend originally, becomes in the hand of Goethe a kind of lyric of love and tears. Another kind of story of thwarted love. In other words, it's personalized. But at the beginning of nationalism, it will not be personalized. It will become part of the spontaneous origins of the people. And here you have something else that I must point out. Not only is this kind of Werther romanticism a quest which becomes in the end a quest for genuineness, for personalization, for fulfillment. This bourgeois, anti-bourgeois revolution at the end of the century with the avant-garde, with impressionism, expressionism, the youth movement, and all of that. But the dream is, of course, also taken up by the beginning of nationalism. Nationalism, as you will read in Rousseau, your next reading for the government of Poland, nationalism at the beginning had this tremendous, tremendous appeal because it really tried to do two things. It, first of all, it put before you the dream of self-fulfillment, the innocent delusion, the dream of self-fulfillment, the dream of genuineness. It tried to put you outside rules and regulations, to go back, as you will see with Herder and others, to the roots of the people, to spontaneity, to genuineness, to the dream. It will try to fulfill the dream, but what is still better, it will try to fulfill it in a community, but a community of affinity. Not a community of rules and regulations, but a community of affinity. So that at the beginning, and I suppose to this day, nationalism tries to put itself forward as a community of affinity, of spontaneity, but a community, not Werther's loneliness, but a community, but still a community of Werther's. A community which will enable Werther to fulfill himself, in marrying Charlotte, in becoming part of a community of innocence, which the nation is supposed to be, by the way, a community of innocence, a community of genuineness, but also, of course, as we know, a community of death. In the end, the young people who rushed to the colors in 1914 were playing out the drama of nationalism. They played it out to their death, the drama of nationalism, the community of affinity, the quest for the exceptional, the quest for the festival, the quest, as it were, for innocence. All of this you have here. Now let me summarize, therefore, what Goethe in Werther tried to do. First of all, notice the mood. Romanticism is a mood. A mood at the beginning of industrialization, at the beginning of the speed of time, at the beginning of all the things I've mentioned so often. Secondly, it is a search for personalization. In an impersonal world, the search for innocence in a world of cities, of factories. It is a search for the genuine, defined as nature, in a world when man was already begin his despoiling of nature, his destruction of nature. And thirdly, it is the search for community. But first, the community of man and nature. The first community that Werther finds. Werther only finds one community, the community with nature, either the community with the garden or the community with the brook on next to which he sits, the community with trees. Just as the English from the highly industrialized nation rushed to the Alps to find a community they missed in England, the community of the mountains. Man's community here is nature, because it is genuine, because he makes it a part of himself. And then in nationalism, as you will see in Rousseau, community become your ancestors, because I shall come to history in a minute. Because in Romanticism, the community receives another dimension in Romanticism. That is, history becomes part of the community. Your ancestors and those who descended from your ancestors. A community like nature, not artificial, but genuine. A community not made from the outside by rules and regulations, but a genuine community which expresses itself in genuine manner. In genuine manner, what is the genuine manner? It expresses itself in fairy tales, in folk songs, in dances, folk dances. The first expressions of nationalism are folk songs, folk dances. In other words, a community in which you can join, which is genuine, just as you can join into nature. You climb mountains, and even Werther joins with nature. Nature reflects its moods. So the community which is coming, the community of the future, the community of nationalism, because the nation is the future, nationalism is the future, is a community in which you can join with your soul. That's the clue. That's the vocabulary of nationalism. You join it with your soul. You join it with your soul. That is to say, your fellow citizens become part of your soul. The abstract has to be made concrete, and it is Rousseau who first does so in The Social Contract, but above all in what you will read there, the government of Poland, he tries to make it, as it were, concrete. And here again, woman becomes the symbol of this, the symbol of the dream, both as the national symbol, as Germania, Britannia, or Marianne. Woman is the symbol of the dream, the symbol of innocence, the flower symbolizes the nation. The national flower is important. It even came to America. I don't know today, but in my youth, when I used to go around another state than this, giving commencement addresses, there was always the class flower that was pinned on you. And it was usually a rose or indeed a flower that had some relation to this flower mysticism and the color blue, which is the Christian liturgical color. And the rose is, of course, the flower of the Virgin Mary, traditionally. So there is this flower mysticism which is tied into it. I don't know whether you still have class flowers when you graduated. Probably not. But anyway, women flowers become the symbol of the dream. The dream of fulfillment out of the dreariness of daily life. Just, and I come back to that, as the chief and most famous German soldier song of the First World War was, "How happy I am to have left behind me wife and children and the dreariness of daily life." I shall come back to what that has to do with male society later. But the dreariness of middle class life, the dreariness, and the political importance is clear, that when the revolt against middle class life comes, it is apt to be lesser revolt of social and economic proportions, but more a quest to the blue flower, more a revolt of the avant-garde than a revolt of the proletariat, obviously. But that you'll be told very little, because historians have great difficulty in dealing with what I have just said, because it isn't concrete and it doesn't have to do with politics and social history in the usual sense. But it is, after all, what has formed generations, this idea. Immediately, Werther was of the greatest importance. It isn't only that there's a whole literature about Werthers. It isn't only that many young men committed suicide after reading the book. There was a whole wave in Germany of suicides after reading this book. It isn't only this. It is the condemnation about this book. It was castigated that men should follow his natural drives, was thought to be dangerous, that girls will now look only for Werthers who only exist in Goethe's imagination and otherwise will remain spinsters. Thus they will not marry and mankind will die out, as one pamphlet has it. The book had a tremendous effect, of a kind of controversy. The passion unleashed can lead to all sorts of excesses, a tremendous controversy about this kind of books. There was, as I told you last time, even a Werther costume into which people dressed. There was a Werther almost everything from now on in, because it hit the spot in a sense that it hit a definite kind of nerve center. But the real long-range consequences, of course, people were only dimly aware of in this controversy, that Werther, Rousseau, Novalis would start really a kind of counter-revolution to middle-class life, that it would lead to the disaffection from manners and morals, from the kind of middle-class life, from the kind of not only Nathan, but pietism and evangelism itself would be challenged. And yet, Werther has much the same problem built into it as pietism and evangelism. It needed an anchor. It needed an anchor. It's all very well to talk about misunderstood genius, about suicide, but for a movement to be historically important, it needs some kind of anchor, some kind of institutionalization, as I told you last time. Institutionalization in politics or in education, as evangelism did have, and as you will see when you read Tom Brown's School Days. But the institutionalization of Romanticism was to be in the end in nationalism. But more immediately, it was to have another dimension which served as anchor. And that dimension was what we might call the rediscovery of history. History, the stream of history, served in a way as the river banks within which the emotion flowed. History served to dam in the emotions unleashed, the dream, the unfulfilled longing. Reason was not enough. Reason was not enough in the age of the railways, in the age that the speed of time was ever more accelerating. Reason was not enough. The river banks were built in the end by history. And so you get something else very important. You get an explanation that every theory from now on will be a theory of history. From Hegel to Marx to nationalism, you name it. Every modern theory about life and attitudes, every modern utopia will be a theory of history. And that is why in the 19th century you get the growth of history as a science. You get the growth of the preoccupation with history. Partly it is because, of course, again, the decline of religion. In a way, evangelism and pietism was too vague to serve as permanent riverbeds. Religion was no longer strong enough to fulfill this function. So you could no longer dam in your emotions, or many people could no longer dam their emotions, and emotions could no longer have a riverbed made up, let us say, of the Christian Mass, or of the Virgin Mary, or of Christian symbols. They had become either too vague or too ineffective. You had to have something else. And in a way, I think it would be a right to say that history took the part, that the emotions of Werther were not dammed in by a new religious revival, but by history. By history itself made emotional the Middle Ages, the medieval cathedrals, the knights and ladies of Sir Walter Scott. So I end again with Ivanhoe, which is really what I would have had you read, except I was afraid it was too long. I think if I ever did that again, rather than Werther, which may lead you to suicide or impotence, you know, or, you know, no girl in this class will marry because it's looking for Werthers. She is looking for Werthers, you know, or something like that, which is a very unfeministic statement. The question is, but don't forget, it's not only women who are the other here. Everything is the other. Everything is the other. It's all narcissistic. Everything is the other, not only women. If you like, women are even the better other, the symbols, the garland of flowers, as it were. Yes, this kind of idea. But everything here is the others. But I come back to Ivanhoe, which, as I must remind you, mixes everything, mixes history, plays in the Middle Ages, mixes the quest for self-fulfillment by Ivanhoe, but above all by Richard the Lion. The opposite, as I told you, to rules and regulations, the way the rule of Richard Coeur de Lion is described by Sir Walter Scott. Nature, Robin Hood enters, plays a big part in one part of Ivanhoe, Robin Hood, and finally Rebecca, one of the models of woman as the symbol. Woman as the symbol not only of the nature but of innocence, of romanticism, and eventually the symbol of history. The symbol of history. Women turn back towards history, not forward towards the future. Woman as a national symbol turns back, always turns back towards history. Long dresses, crowns, medieval symbols, Germania, Britannia, Marianne eventually as well, they all turn back. Woman turns back. She becomes a metaphor of the guardian of tradition. The guardian of tradition, which she certainly wasn't in the 18th century, which she certainly wasn't in the 17th century, but which you almost take for granted now. She was a guardian of tradition. The guardian of tradition, which means the guardian of innocence. Of innocence. The guardian of the garden. And all of that sort of thing will determine, of course, her role in the future. But we cannot quite leave it there. We have to go back now and look for a minute more detailed next Wednesday on the romantic idea of history, because history is so important. It will determine many things. Well, you know it already. If you look at the Houses of Parliament in Britain, they were built by a romantic architect, Pugin, in the Gothic model. Cologne Cathedral, Milan Cathedral were finished in the 19th century. Most Rhine castles or German castles, which you think are medieval, were built in the 19th century, of course. So that you have an architectural revival, which is quite obvious. But there is more to it. Now, on Monday, we have the 6 weeks, and on Wednesday, I'll return to that.